Hello, everyone. This is Dan Mills coming to you from the President's Room high atop D.C. Bar headquarters at 1101 K Street in Washington, D.C. Today's program is choosing a business entity for your D.C. law firm, and we will hear from Heather Batzel of Batzel Law, PLLC, and Maxine Henson of D.C. Regulatory Affairs. We are joining the program in progress, and Rochelle Washington has just begun welcoming our guests.
We have with us today Heather Batzel and Maxine Henson. Heather is with Batzel Law, and she's going to tell you about choosing corporate entities for your law firm. And Maxine Henson is directly from the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, which is awesome, because when you call, sometimes it's not as easy to get in touch. I'm sure they get a lot of calls. But we've got an excellent resource right before us. Use her, raise your hand, ask all those great questions, and I will let them take over. Again, if you did not sign in, please do so before you go. Thank you, everyone.
Great. Thank you, Rochelle. Good afternoon, and welcome to Business Entity Formation for Law Firms. Obviously, your selection of a form of entity through which to conduct your business is a foundational issue, and the implications continue beyond the time when you register or choose not to register an entity. So today we will talk about a menu of entities relevant to your prospective law firm endeavor, as well as a number of the considerations that go into that decision. As Rochelle mentioned, I'm Heather Batzel. I have my law firm, Batzel Law, PLLC, here in D.C. I formed my law firm last year after 10 years of corporate work in big law and a couple of in-house posts, the first of which was at the World Bank and then several years with an international company based here in D.C. I work with entrepreneurs, including startups, emerging companies, and small businesses in general, working with them on their corporate counsel and transactional and business regulatory needs. And I too, am delighted to have Mrs. Henson here with us today. I have found over my past 10 or so years of practice in D.C. that the DCRA has continually modernized, and that's reflected by really great references that are available on the website. But I don't think anything compares to having a senior specialist with the DCRA in the Corporations Division here to answer our questions and provide practical guidance. Mrs. Henson, anything you want to add?
Well, I want to say that I'm with the corporate division. I've been on the DCRA since its inception, which was 1983 when they did a reorganization act in the District of Columbia under Plan 1. The corporate part used to be under the Recorder Deeds Office. And so when they reorganized, they changed it over the corporate part to the Department of Consumer Regulatory Affairs. So I always say that for DCRA and for corporations or LLCs, we are the first step, and then it's the domino effect. That's what I call it. It's because you have to create the entity first. You know, corporations are what we call creatures of the statute. And that you create the organization, and then you secure any type of permits or licensing that you may need. Now, you're in a unique particular situation because if you're a law practice, and you don't need a license from us unless you're doing some other things that you may need a license because you're already licensed, a professional type of license. But when you incorporate or form a formation of a PLLC or an LLP or limited partnership, then you have to come to DCRA, whether you decide to form in the District of Columbia or if you organize in another state, you have to do a registration as required by statute.
Great. Great overview of things we'll discuss. So today we're going to provide a survey of entities that are focused on law firms. There will be entities that you've heard of or you know about that aren't included here because they're just not the primary entities that law firms are considering in their formation. But a few disclaimers first, of course. I think we're all lawyers here. This isn't tailored advice and it shouldn't be relied upon. What makes sense for you and what legal advice would apply is fact-specific, and obviously this forum doesn't work with that the tailored advice. Additionally, my expertise is corporate law, and I'm not an ethics counsel, and I'm not a tax advisor. I may mention things that are useful from my own experience, but those types of things you should also double-check with proper competent counsel. And finally, I'm licensed in D.C. and Maryland only, so insofar as a hypothetical we discuss or a question where I refer to other jurisdictions, I'm not opining on those laws. All right. So that's what it isn't, but how should you use this presentation given what I've said? I suggest you note questions and to-do items that you want to research and review in greater depth to sort out what structure you're most interested in. We're aiming to provide you a launching point and a general understanding of what types of things are involved in forming and operating your law firm. Here's a question for you. By show of hands, where are you in the continuum of business formation? Some people I might know. Some, who is about to form their law firm? Already in business and contemplating. Oh, one, or two, three, four. Oh, I got to look a little better if I'm going to ask questions, right? Four. Who's already in business in contemplating whether or not this is the right entity or what might be? Just curious and contemplating. One, two. And otherwise, just considering. Don't have your own law firm, just considering what all is involved. Okay. A little spread, and a couple of new people come in. Just sit. So our outline for discussion will be to have an overview of some background material and threshold issues. Then to move into select entity types and in particular discuss their characteristics. We will then try to provide a good amount of practical and procedural advice, including how you actually register an entity type and things you do after that, and then conclude with some takeaways in what you might do after this presentation. Throughout, Mrs. Hinson will provide practical insights and the D.C. government perspective. And if you have any questions for either of us, please feel free to raise your hand, and we'll try to work in the answers to those. Yes?
Are you planning to provide your slides to people who signed up?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Why don't anyone who would like them, maybe make sure I have your contact information at the end. So, I want to talk a bit about some general background. The authority for our presentation is the D.C. Code Title 29 D.C. Business Organizations Act. The D.C. laws pertaining to business entities was completely overhauled in 2010 and entered into law in 2012. And, I think it's pretty good. It's pretty user-friendly. It conforms in some respects with model practice and uniform laws that in a way that it didn't conform before. And so that would be the authority you'd look to for any further information if you want to go straight to the source. The other general contextual point I want to make are what the primary selection drivers are when people are evaluating what type of business makes sense for their endeavor. And you see them up on the screen, but to pose them as questions, I would say, what kind of risks do I have? What will my tax burden be? How much headache will running my firm cause me? Who's in charge? How are decisions made? And how much is this all going to cost me? Do any of those ring a bell? Is that the kind of, did I miss any? Anything that's on your mind that I didn't mention? Okay, great.
How do you choose which state?
Great. Good. And I'll talk a little bit about that later. Don't let me forget. And then we have some special circumstances for law firms. I think it's important to get this out of the way at the outset. Lawyers can't disclaim your professional liability. So when we're talking about limited liability with the different entity types, that still may be recommended. We're talking about a subset of liability. And it doesn't mean it's not relevant. You might have contractual liability for business acts. You might have tort liability, liability pertaining to your employees if you have any problems with your landlord. And then something we'll talk about a bit later in partnership type entities are liability for the professional negligence of your partners or even a claim. I mean, they don't have you might be pretty confident that neither you nor any of your partners would commit malpractice, but that doesn't mean someone won't sue at some point. And so there, while you're going to be responsible for your own professional liability, you might be able to disclaim responsibility for other people's. D.C., Mrs. Hinson touched on this. D.C. has some specific requirements and limitations and the requisite entity forms applicable to law firms, and that's particularly that a corporation needs to be named a professional corporation and does have some added regulatory guidance that goes with that. Well, not guidance, regulations that go with that. And limited liability companies need to be professional limited liability companies. One other point I want to make is that financing, it just really struck me throughout my preparation for this for today, that financing is such a big driver in entity selection in the non-law firm world. You know, if you plan to go public, if you plan to bring on venture capital firms as investors, there are limitations that will often drive towards the corporate form in particular. And some of those factors that typically would recommend one form over another, I find to be generally not relevant for law firms. So that'll be a bit of a theme throughout. And finally, ethical rules. We all know we have our rules of professional conduct. We need to adhere to those. So even insofar as, you know, DC government permits us to act in a certain way with regard to how we name our firm or how we engage in the practice of law, you always have to look together with the ethical rules that apply for that endeavor, for that issue. Because we're talking about law firms, I focused in on this select entity type list, the sole proprietorship or sole prop, sometimes referred to it, the general partnership, the limited liability partnership, the professional corporation, the professional limited liability company, and leaving off at least that many entities that I don't think are as applicable for today. And basically you have two buckets. The first two are the unlimited liability forms, and then the latter three are your limited liability entities. A sole proprietorship is simply an individual conducting business for himself or herself. It automatically arises under law. You don't need to file in order to have one. You just do.
Now, I want to mention one thing about the sole proprietor, if you decide to use a sole proprietor. We require, and this is it's a requirement, if you use a name. Say, for instance, you're in practice and your name is Jane Doe, but you want to have your firm name, Jane's Law Firm or something like that. And that's considered what we call a trade name. So you have to do a trade name registration under the sole proprietor. The owner of the trade name is going to be you as an individual person. So you would be the individual person, owner of the trade name, but you have to file what they call a trade name registration.
Okay. Quick question about that. So if I just use my normal name, do I need to...
No, if you just use your normal name, and under the trade name law, you can't register the trade name under your own personal name. You have to have something else added to it, but if you just use your own personal name, then you don't need a trade name. But it's only when you use another name, like a DBA, then you need to file the trade name registration.
Excuse me for the clarification. If I use my name and the word behind law, behind my name, that's considered to be a trade name?
That's considered different. You know, your practice, you might be Jane Myers, but if you're on your marquee at your door or something like that, you have Jane Myers Law Firm or something like that.
Or Jane Myers Law.
Right, but the word law is a little different than what your name is. You know, you're adding something to it. But so you would file what they call a trade name registration.
Sorry to go to another level of nuance, but does that also apply to Jane Doe, comma, attorney at law?
If they're using like Esquire or attorney at law, then no, you don't have to. It's only when you use the name that it would concede to the public that
it's a company.
It's a company or some type of business or whatever. So you wouldn't have, if it's attorney at law or Esquire or something like that,
And where would we go to search that? There must be a database online.
To find out if a name's taken mm-hmm. or not?
Oh, yeah. Now, the other thing is that when they changed the law in 2010 under this new business organization, before with the trade names, we would take trade names even though they might have been used by somebody else, you know. But now under the trade name law, the name can't be the same as something else. Now, if you register with the DCRA's website, then there's a section on there that says search business entities or search register business entities, and then you can do a search of names like that. But just don't rely on that. Sometimes you can file the trade name, and if it's something comes up, we'll let you know because it'll be rejected, and we'll tell you. Usually we'll tell people to add something to it, or either the modified, or either we'll say the name's not distinguishable from another record that we have.
So the sole prop has a lot to be said for it in that it is easy. You don't need to file, other than the types of things we just discussed, you don't need to file to establish it. You don't have to adhere to any corporate formalities. You don't have to keep the money separate. You can just run with it. All the profits are yours, subject to tax ramifications, and you report the income on your regular individual tax return. But the big disadvantage is that you have unlimited personal liability. And that means that if you enter into a contract with Lexis, it's in your name, you don't pay. Lexis, you could have a surprise. You could all of a sudden do a search that costs $5,000 and run that a couple times, and all of a sudden, you run up $120,000. If you refuse to pay, they can sue you, and they can go after your big assets, attach your bank accounts, go after your house. Maybe not the most likely scenario, but that is an example of the unlimited personal liability that you have. A couple of other lesser disadvantages of the sole prop are you need to pay self-employment taxes. Sole props are not the only entity that you need to do that for, but that's a factor. You don't have unemployment benefits or really any security in your job, and there are some limitations that I won't go into, but there is some differential tax treatment in deductible items across different business entities. And then the other one is that the life of the business is tied to the life of the owner. The stability of entity and continuity of life is something that I myself don't fuss a lot over, because in most, if not all, of the entities, at least that we'll discuss today, you can get around it. I mean, it's true, if you have a law firm and you die, there is no law firm left. There's no Heather Batzel law firm as a sole prop if I die. But that doesn't mean that effectively, practically speaking, someone couldn't swoop in and, take over, or your family couldn't help manage, let someone know who would be the trusted attorney that you'd want to leave your things in the hands of. So it's true, but I think it's a much lesser disadvantage than unlimited personal liability. Okay, moving on to partnerships. Partnerships are similar to a sole proprietorship in that it just a general partnership just arises under law when two or more people come together to conduct business and share in the profits. There are rules and a lot of default rules that are contained in the Uniform Partnership Act of 2010, which is Chapter 6 of Title 29 of the D.C. Code. And then there is a special type of general partnership allowable under the D.C. Code called a limited liability partnership. An LLP is not to be confused with an LP or an LLLP. Those are different. An LLP is a type of GP. Let me know if you got lost. but in short, limited liability partnership is defined as a partnership that's made a certain election with a statement of qualification under D.C. Code. The characteristics, as we discussed, there's no cost or filing required to form the general partnership. In the operation, minimal legal requirements apply. You do have the pass-through taxation. As such, this unregistered entity with pass-through taxation has the separate legal person and unlimited personal liability. So there you have the unlimited personal liability again. But actually, one thing I wanted to invite Mrs. Hinson to comment on is this no cost or filing required. It's actually something called a statement of partnership authority under D.C. law, which seems to be permissive and not required.
With the general partnership at this time, we do have some general partnerships on record, but under the new law, we don't have a workflow or form for the general partnership. So basically, they just do business on their own. Now, sometime they might come into problems when they go to the bank, you know, to open up a bank account, if they can't provide them proof that they're actually registered under that name, and then that's when the trade name comes in. But under the trade name rule, they have to register the trade name as a sole proprietor doing business as, and then sometimes they might have a conflict with their partner because they want both names on it, but for a sole proprietor, that just means one person. Yeah, and then with the DC tax, sometimes you might go over to the Office of Tax and Revenue and register with them, and then they'll say, are you registered with DCRA? And if you're not, then they'll come back to us and they'll have to file something with us. And the majority of the times when they do file, it's going to be the LLP form that they use.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great segue into focusing now on the LLP to avoid the pesky unlimited liability that your GP would have typically. So the LLP, as we discussed, is a special form of the general partnership that affords limited liability to the partners. That limited liability, again, does not disclaim your professional liability for your legal services, but you can disclaim your liability for the malpractice of your partners. In fact, when these were coming into being, the LLP, I think 30 or 40 years ago, that was actually I don't think in the law firm context, but with accountants, was the reason why LLPs came into being, because the idea was that while generally you're bound by the activities of your business partners, it's not particularly fair in the case of negligence where you didn't have anything to do with the bad outcome that you also be on the hook. Did you have a question?
Well, I read someplace that it was triggered by the 70s and loan crisis when they went after the accountants.
And that's right. In the 80s.
I would just like to clarify that. I've read this statute, and there's no LLP statute. You can't find it because it's just a section of the GP statute.
Mm-hmm. That's right, section
like
10.
Section 8 or something says. And mm-hmm. by the way, mm-hmm. if you want to do this LLP thing, here, file this one.
Well, if you think that is cryptic, check out, try to find the authority for PLLCs in the code.
I haven't tried.
That'll be fun, you know, fun follow-up activity for you. Okay, so moving on. So the advantages of the LLP is the limited liability. The limited liability is the same as for corporations. It's for the business acts of the entity as well as the malpractice of other partners, provided you're not involved in or supervising or supposed to be supervising their activities. And then you have the financial and tax benefits, the single taxation at the owner level, the ability to allocate income, loss, distributions, and profits as you see fit. It's generally flexible in its operation as compared to the corporation, and perhaps not so much necessarily as compared to the LLC, which we'll discuss later. The disadvantages of an LLP in general is you're bound by the actions of your partners. They have authority to act typically on behalf of the partnership, and other people are entitled to rely on that. Partnership tax, maybe some of you know it and understand it well, but it's generally considered to be a complex area of law. Despite the flow-through taxation flow-through tax treatment, you do have a partnership return. There are K-1s that need to be issued, and then there's a DC-specific partnership tax return on Form D-65. There are some distribution restrictions in the Chapter 10 of Chapter 6 of the DC Code that restrict distributions, but those pertain to making the partnership go into debt such that it can't make its payments to creditors by making distributions. So I don't think that's a really big drawback. You shouldn't do that in general, regardless of the business form. Self-employment taxes apply, and you can't be employees. You can't have the standing of an employee when it's an LLP, and the same is true for the LLC we'll discuss later. You know, that from my perspective, that's not a, you can't do it. You can't accomplish the same outcome. It's just that you have to work around it. If you can't be an employee of the entity, you need to figure out how you're going to get paid, what the implications are for the taxes for that. Go ahead.
Something I should point out is that I've read that you had better call yourself either an employee the IRS will decide which one will generate the more taxes. So be very clear as to what you think your employee is.
Yeah, and I think if you're an owner, you're a partner. And that doesn't mean you can't have profits. They just take a different form.
Right, and obviously you can't have, a partnership can have employees.
Yes.
Am I right that a partnership has to have at least two partners, right?
Exactly.
Never sold a partnership.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Moving on to corporations. Yes, sure. Yeah, that maybe not technically, but I think that's a good practical way of looking at it.
Yeah, just to consider.
The tax treatment is different, but yes, I mean it happens automatically and it has unlimited tax treatment, unlimited liability. Excuse me, if you don't elect to have the limited liability partnership treatment under the DC code.
Okay, and the difference is the tax. Right.
The difference between a sole prop and a general partnership. I think the tax documentation is more complex, but they're both pass-through entities for tax purposes. Federal tax purposes and typically state, including DC.
Any thoughts on where the line is as far as sharing profits and losses and kind of minimizing the sharing that goes on between partners before it ceases to be a part of a true partnership?
Can you restate it?
Definition, my understanding, legal definition of two partners is that they're in business together sharing profits and losses. But what if you have a structure where you want to minimize the profits that go to one particular partner and or the losses?
Yeah, the default is that you would be splitting profits and losses equally, but you can decide to have a different structure. But if you decide to have another structure, while the agreement in LLP does not need to be in writing, you might want to make sure that's in writing, because the default provision is the one that you need to prevail over. Well, at least if you're the one that's supposed to get more money, you want to make sure it's in writing. There are other things we'll talk about later that I think strongly recommend having governing documents, including partnership agreements or their corollary for the different entity types in place. Corporations. So a corporation is a separate legal entity that has been incorporated through a registration process under the law. DC has this, and the authority is contained in Chapter 3 of Title 29. Law firms are rendering professional services and therefore need to register as professional corporations if they're going to register for the corporate form. And so the authority then is Chapter 3 together with Chapter 5. Chapter 5 of Title 29 deals with professional corporations.
Right. So the thing that I would point out is that when you form the professional corporation, you also have to meet the requirements of the business corporation as far as, stating the amount of shares that the corporation is authorized to issue. But there are, some additional requirements for the professional corporation, because you're going to have to state the name of the original shareholders of the corporation. And usually you would include a statement that they're licensed to practice law or whatever the particular professional service.
I have a question for you on that. So the code... as you said, states that you are to include a statement that all owners are duly licensed in the profession for which the corporation is being formed. What about where you have, setting aside our rules of professional conduct, what about where you have a licensed professional but not licensed in D.C.? Do you have an opinion on
Well,
that?
We've had certain cases where we've gotten opinions from the Corporation Counsel's office where they have a law firm that they want to bring in somebody who's an officer of the corporation, but they're not licensed in the District of Columbia. So basically, one of the opinions that we had was that as long as they don't hold themselves out as being licensed, on their letterhead, they have the bars that they're in. They'll have DC if they're DC, you'll have PA for Pennsylvania, whatever state it is. So they can't hold themselves out and they can't, you know, go into the Superior Court and practice law or whatever. And the other thing is that there was a case where, you know, if it's a secretary that you have, as long as that person's not practicing law or holding yourself out as that, so that's how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
There are some cases where we've had professional corporations where they have someone auxiliary to the service that they're having. They want to have somebody. I know you've seen these law firms who say, well, I'm a medical doctor, but I'm also a licensed attorney for, you know, so they can give their advice or, you know, counsel for that particular type of business.
Does that work with a PC?
Well, if they're going to do it in a district, if they're going to practice law, then they have to be licensed.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, as long as they don't hold themselves out as a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
That's licensed here in the district,
mm-hmm.
They do have reciprocity. You know, a lot of cases where they can just apply to the Superior Court to get licensed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great.
A follow-up question on that, Ms. Henson. Our rules of professional conduct allow a non-lawyer partner.
The same question, Dan.
So let's say a new firm is coming in and they want to be a PLLC in the District of Columbia, but they have a non-lawyer partner. Are they going to have to be an LLC?
Well, if they, you know, we get that question a lot. A lot of times, in fact, there are some LLCs in the district that are not PLLCs. And I know that for a fact because they're saying, well, I don't want to be a PLLC because they don't really know, a lot of them don't really know the definition of a PLLC, which is a professional limited liability company. And you can't, as you said, when you try to research it, it's a little small section that's in the act that says that you're supposed to basically meet the same requirements as a professional corporation when it comes to the PLLC. So it's kind of like a gray area. I can't say that people, you know, don't do it. And, of course, if they have a particular provision in the professional standards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this question, you know, I think the answer is probably that it remains unclear. The way that professional corporations are defined in the BC code says that you all have to be licensed in the profession for which that entity exists. There are transfer restrictions on transferring to someone who, in this case, isn't a lawyer, it's a law firm. And I myself have wondered, does that undermine whether or not the PC is the right form for certain people, depending on what your broader goal is for your firm? Do you want to have a firm with a lobbying arm or a firm with, a profit-sharing CEO? And unlike the PC's restriction, the LLP doesn't have it. The LLP in D.C., unlike some other jurisdictions, does not require, even though it's kind of came about and is contemplated as an entity for professionals, in D.C., there isn't a requirement to be professional. So it might be that LLPs are more flexible in the profit-sharing and the transferability.
Right, and basically it's kind of silent in that particular statute when it comes to the type of practice or whatever service or business that they're doing. Now, the other thing is that I've had some corporations that were PC, professional corporations, where the primary person died, and then their family or their wife wants to take over the law firm. Well, what they do is they file an amendment, but because when they file the amendment, they change from the PC to a regular business corporation,
mm-hmm.
and they have to change the purpose and the name of the corporation to Inc. or corporation.
Do they still try to provide legal services?
No, they can't provide the legal service. Yeah, they just have to get it in a different. Mm-hmm. They can do consulting,
mm-hmm.
because consulting does not mean that you're practicing
mm-hmm.
law.
Great. So the characteristics that I'll mention with regard to the professional corporation. You only need one to form. You can have more than one shareholder if you want. One or more directors is the default. There's this qualification requirement that we've discussed, and then there's the, you know, generally corporations are viewed as being easily transferable in their interests, but we talked about the qualification just now with regard to a professional corporation that has to be to another lawyer. It has the stability of perpetual duration because it's a separate legal person, but it has double taxation, and that's a big drawback. So the advantages are the limited liability, but here's the authority just for your reference. With regard to professional corporations, you can't disclaim your liability arising out of your professional service. the transferability, you know, if you're transferring to another lawyer, is there as a potential advantage. The stability, owners can be employees too, so you can structure it such that you're an employee, you have employee benefits, you don't have to do self-employment taxes, the company does withholdings, the corporation does withholdings, and you have that kind of comfortable sense that perhaps you prefer and are used to. this benefit of not paying self-employment taxes, I think can be a bit of a red herring, because if you're talking about a small company, whether it's just you or three of you, whether you pay self-employment taxes are comprised of roughly 15% of your income until you reach a certain threshold, that are your Social Security, FICA, and Medicare taxes. It comes out to about 15%. When you're employed with a company, typically the company's paying like 7.5%, and then you're paying 7.5% as part of your payroll taxes. But if you're the owner, or if you're the owner, equal owner with two other people, whether you pay it out of the corporation, and then you get your salary, and then whatever's left you get distributed as profits, or you have to pay it yourself, might not make any difference. Now, when you take into account the exact structure, the deductibility of certain expenses, including payroll withhold, tax withholdings, maybe there is some distinction, but it's not as big as I think, not as profound as sometimes you would be led to believe by the way that sometimes the self-employment tax burden is talked about. So some of the disadvantages of a professional corporation is the double taxation. The complexity in operation, specifically, you really need to adhere to the corporate formalities. If you don't, then you jeopardize your limited liability status. And so if you're going to the, you know, if you have the extra burden, you have the double taxation, you have more complexity in how you're running your business, you certainly don't want to not do everything you need to maintain your limited liability status. There's considered to be less flexibility in general. And the PC, unlike the regular corp, has the restriction on ownership. Yes.
You say employees can be owners. I guess because it's a PC, it can only be employees who are professionals mm-hmm. who can be owners.
Yeah, I agree. And
then another question is there can a law firm who's a PC provide non-legal services, at least in Virginia, mediation is considered a non-legal. It's not the practice of law
mm-hmm.
In Virginia. I think maybe other places it's different, but in Virginia, mediation is not the practice of law. Clearly, lots of lawyers, law firms, you know, one day he's wearing his practice law hat, and the next day he's doing a mediation. In D.C., is there does the fact that the attorneys in a PC are doing things other than practicing law jeopardize the PC status?
Do you have an opinion on this?
I would say no. I would say I don't think it would.
And I'm not sure. Generally, I would want to look at the code specific with that to that question in mind. generally, it talks about just rendering the professional services for which it is formed. But if I dug deeper, I'm not sure if it would really prohibit that or not. One thing I wanted to mention. Oh, go ahead, Ben.
There's one, just FYI, something to run by accountants. My understanding is there's one tax upside to having a PC or C corporation for tax purposes, in that if you purchase health insurance for the whole firm, the health insurance expense comes right off the top, deductible for purposes of income tax and employment taxes. Whereas I believe if you have an LLC, sole proprietorship, or a partnership, you rely on the self-employment health insurance deduction, which does not reduce employment taxes.
Awesome.
So I've heard of some law firms using corporate.
Ben Takis, he knows tax. He does it primarily with nonprofits, but he knows some for-profit stuff as well. Thank you, I appreciate that. And then one thing I didn't mention in the PC discussion, so some of you might be wondering, well, wait a minute, I know C corps have a lot of these attributes we just talked about, but what about the S-Corp? Because the S-Corp is meant to eliminate that double taxation. And the reason I don't talk a lot about it in this presentation is because DC does not recognize the S-Corp status. So that doesn't mean you wouldn't have the federal S-corp treatment, but the taxation burden for a DC S-corp is not going to be as beneficial as the tax treatment for the LLP or the LLC or the sole prop. Limited liability companies. So limited liability companies, I actually pulled a definition off of Wikipedia because I really like it. I think it's informative. A limited liability company is a flexible form of enterprise that blends elements of partnership and corporate structures. It's not a corporation. It is a legal form of company that provides limited liability to its owners. This is a statutory being, and the specifics do vary by state. But there's quite a bit of uniformity as well. So basically, it's a hybrid that draws on the advantageous attributes of corporations and partnerships. The DC has a requirement that if you are a limited liability company engaging in professional services, as professional services are defined, that you form a professional limited liability company. And the clearest language that you will find is simply definition 38 in chapter 1 that describes what a professional limited liability company means. That's what it's saying. It can be a bit of a rabbit hole trying to find. There isn't a separate section on it. There is not a subchapter under the LLC chapter. But it is a requirement. And you will, the other main place you will find it is if you try to form an LLC in the form itself, it will ask you if you are professional, if you're providing professional services, and then guide you towards the naming that's required. So the PLLC has limited liability. It's highly flexible. It can be one member. It can be more than one member. And income and expenses it's a pass-through entity. Income and expenses are generally reported up on, through the individual tax return. I think there is a partnership return that would apply in the case of a multi-member. Yeah, even though I didn't quite note that here. The advantages are mostly what we just talked about. We have the single taxation, the limited liability, highly flexible, and potentially simple. And the reason I refer to it as potentially simple is because you have so much flexibility that you can have a really simple LLC, and you might have a really, really, really simple LLC if you are one person and you have a single member LLC. It'd be like a 6-page agreement that covers everything that you need to know in, as far as your operating agreement. But they can get very, very complicated too. And I've worked on both sides of the spectrum with competent tax advisors because it does get very tricky very fast. But what I like about it is you can keep it simple, but if you deem it appropriate, you can make it more complex to achieve your objectives and your tax treatment that you want. The disadvantages, with the flexibility and the ability to make it what you want, you need to make sure you do that in a correct way. And so there are lots of tax implications, particularly, especially when you have partners. I can't imagine entering into a multi-member limited liability company operating agreement without tax advice, because there are going to be things in that agreement that just do not give rise to the intended outcome, unless you are a tax specialist yourself. So you need competent tax advisors to set it up in a proper way, and you might need legal counsel. Of course, we're lawyers, so for some people this will be within their area of comfort, and for other people, you would seek a competent legal advisor other than yourself. There are the potential partnership tax complexities if it is a partnership. If it is if it's more than one person that comes together to form this LLP or this LLC, you are very similar to a partnership. There's the DC franchise tax applicability. And that is the Form D-30 due in April of every year. And it's approximately 10%. And, it's something that you want to take into account and discuss with your tax advisor. Because, for example, if you are a single member LLC And do I see some shocked faces? if you're a single member LLC, but you have employees, you might have this extra tax burden of 10%. I think it's 9.75%. And it carries with it estimated tax payment requirements on a quarterly basis, and then has a 10% annual interest rate compounded daily. I actually asked my husband, who's really good at math, whether or not that compounding daily made a huge difference, because I thought, wow, that could just be astronomical. I think it comes out to more like 10.5% annualized. But still, it's not a small tax. However, there is a potential exemption, which I was delighted to hear about personally when I was looking at this issue for my own practice. And that is that if 80% or more of the revenues are derived from owners providing the services for which the company is formed, then generally you don't need to file the D-30. Again, qualified, talk to your tax advisors, but that was the Hail Mary outcome that I found out when I was contemplating my business. Okay, so hey, you guys are really real troopers. I was thinking people are going to be asleep by now. In fact, I even brought candy to try to keep you awake, so I'm going to pass it out. But do you have a question?
I don't know if you want to kind of add a form to these things, but the DC Bar website, as well as the Orange State Bar, have got forms for LLC, which is kind of an interesting topic, because who would ever form an LLC itself? It's kind of a strange thing to do. But
an LLC?
The Bar of DC or New York have solved that problem.
Oh, yeah. Okay, understood. I'm going to speak to that for a moment, but I want to pass these around. All right, to keep you awake, I have lots of candy. It's Halloween week, right? So we should have treats, too. Please help yourself. It's a huge bag. I have chocolate, and I have caramels in case you don't like chocolate. And if you don't like either of those, I can't help you. Have some water. Stay awake. Stretch. Here we go.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, please take a lunch.
So if you're active in a bar more than D.C., or so outside D.C., which probably most of the people are here, so what if you form an entity in a different state, and then you just want to practice in D.C.?
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to do? Are you going to get to that later?
We can talk about now, because we're kind of in the other considerations camp in jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is on it. So you're saying if you're licensed somewhere else, in D.C., and you want to practice in D.C.?
Let's say you're licensed in New Hampshire, where there's no state income tax,
mm-hmm.
right? So you formed your entity there, but then you practiced also in D.C.
Okay.
So what would you have to do?
Yeah, I think you would, clearly, depending on what you mean by practicing, but if you're in D.C. and you're taking on clients and operating in D.C., you need to register.
Yeah, you would register as a foreign entity. You have to file a form that's called the FN-1 form. And basically on the FN-1 form, it's just a foreign registration, but you also have to attach or upload a certificate of good standing from the Secretary of State or whether New Hampshire or whatever state. That you're organizing. You're also required to have a registered agent for the service of process in the district.
And I think in that case, you'd also need to register with the D.C. Office of Tax and Revenue.
Right.
And that's a form, FR-500, Combined Tax Registration, which I think is a revamped form from just the past couple years that it's been all put together in a combined form. And that is, I think, so that the district can assess what franchise taxes do or don't apply, what employment taxes or unemployment insurance applies. The district wants to be in the driver's seat for determining what you need to do. So you don't just do the corporate registration. You do the corporate registration, but in addition, you need to do a tax registration.
And you may need, depending on where, if you have an office here, you may need what they call an occupancy permit. If you have a residence where you're practicing, have an office in your home, you would need a home, what they call a home occupancy permit.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, if you're in one of those big office buildings, a lot of times when you enter into an agreement, they might have one that would cover you, but you have to check to make sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah. What if you make a subchapter exemption to be taxed in the past? What happens then?
Oh, with regard to LLCs? With regard to all of the questions we just answered. Let's see. Well, your election to be treated as an S corp wouldn't alter your obligation to register if you're doing business in DC.
You have to do that one way or another.
It wouldn't alter your requirement to file the informational combined form FR-500 with DC, and it wouldn't impact what occupancy permits you need either in a commercial space or in your home. And then as far as the tax implications, I won't tell you about my thoughts on those because they might not be accurate. But it's interesting, and we'll talk a little bit more towards the end of the presentation about just in general, how do you make sense of these different entities, because there's a lot of similarities, and that you have your corp that can elect to be an S corp, you have your LLC that can elect to be an S corp, and you know what's the difference and where to come out. But a lot of those rest on the tax determinations, and the tax advisor is better positioned to talk about that. Yeah. So actually, I think it's a good time to pass out one more thing to pass around. This is just a chart on the DCRA corporations division fees. Just a little chart. This information is taken from DCRA, but it's not all in one place there. So I pulled it together with my law clerk. So we're on other considerations. So governing agreements are important. By governing agreements, I mean your partnership agreement in the case of a GP or an LLP, your operating agreement in the case of an LLC. I'm going to speak to what you said about the single-member LLC operating agreement. Your bylaws and your shareholder agreement for a corporation. In particular, what I wanted to say about the single-member limited liability company, a lot of us corporate lawyers, and I think tax lawyers too, find it to be useful and helpful to enter into an agreement, even when you're just a single-member LLC. And in particular, it can give a nudge in the right direction as far as demonstrating that it really is a separate legal entity that should be afforded the limited liability for which you registered it.
I wanted to say that you should also keep separate accounts and records.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You must. Well, you must. I mean, if you're going to form a single member limited liability company, but if you don't, I've seen it happen with clients who are sued, and they weren't. Oftentimes, because it's just you, it's easy to not do everything the right way. Nobody's really looking over your shoulder, and that's another one of the benefits of an operating agreement is you set out what you're going to do, and then you abide by it. And in fact, a side note on that is that you should make sure if you enter into an operating agreement, if you find one online, make sure you tailor it. If it says you shall make distributions on a quarterly basis and you don't, you're out of conformity with your operating agreement, and that tends to demonstrate that you're not treating it as a separate legal entity, and that perhaps you shouldn't be allowed to have the limited liability treatment if and when someone tries to pierce it. So it's useful. Whenever you enter into an agreement with other people, like a partnership or whatever form we've talked about that engages other business partners, then I think the stakes just go up drastically. You want to take into account how you're going to split profits, how you're going to run the business, who has what authority to do what requires what level of consent, what happens if somebody wants out, what's the lifespan of the entity, who can change that. All sorts of things that you want to figure out at the outset. And I don't know all of your practices of law. Oh, yeah, one second. All your practices of law, but I suspect that many of you have been in the position of telling clients, I know you don't think anything bad's going to happen, but trust me, bad stuff happens. Let's get the deal set out on paper before we get to that point. And at the outset, it's the easiest time. What did you want to say?
Can you change the operating agreement retroactively?
Can you
change the operating agreement retroactively?
Do you say, can you change it? Yeah, you can enter into one. Yeah, you can enter into a limited liability company operating agreement whenever you want. If there's more than one member, then you might need everyone to agree to it. If you have one and you're trying to change it, and the initial one says a majority can change the agreement, then a majority can change the agreement. Generally, yes.
And for the operating agreement for a sole member, there is a provision, because I've had this question too, where someone will say, well, I'm a sole member. Do I need an operating agreement? Yes, there is a provision, but it's in the definitions. A lot of times the code, when you look through something, you can't find it where you think it would be. And you have to go through, you know, different sections and see. But there's a provision in the definitions concerning operating agreement that speaks to including, it has the words including a sole member. So, and then I find that sometimes when LLCs or PLLCs, and they don't have an operating agreement that they customize to their needs, and a lot of times when there's some kind of problem with their partners or their members, the managing members or the members of the LLC, if they get into some type of conflict, they really need to have something that's fine-tuned, as she said, an accountant or someone to assist you with those operating agreements, because you'll be surprised. Things that might come up.
Other considerations. Just, you know, now is as good a time as any to just mention the importance of insurance. Whether you're a sole proprietor or you have a complex entity with other people, you know, insurance, including professional liability insurance, is a good idea. I think some jurisdictions require it. I don't think D.C. does. I actually have never checked if D.C. and Maryland require it or not because I knew I was going to get it. and then, you know, you also want to look at commercial general liability policies and other things, but talk to your insurance broker or brokers if you want to scout out what different people say, and talk to your friends who have businesses of their own, lawyers and non-lawyers. So we touched on some of these already. We talked about the trade name and naming. That concept of a trade name and needing to register it applies even to entities that are not sole proprietorships. So, you know, you see this all over the place. They're not law firm specific. I mean, you can call yourself something different than the name that you file with the D.C. government, maybe. You have the desire to do that with respect to certain work that you do, but there's this additional overlay that it needs to be consistent with the rules of professional conduct. But the idea of registering a trade name is that, you know, if you are XYZ company and then you're going, putting yourself out there, marketing yourself as ABC, go get them. If you register that name, then the DCRA knows that these two entities are one and the same, and they can track you down. And one of the things that this is important for is registered agent. And registered agents, in case anyone doesn't know, is just the person that is designated to receive legal notices, service of process, and the like on behalf of your entity. And when you file in DC, to register an entity, whether a domestic entity or registering a foreign entity to do business in D.C., you're going to be asking, you're going to have to fill that out, and there are restrictions as to who can and can't be a registered agent. And then tying that back to the trade name, you know, where you have a trade name and it's registered as affiliated with the actual name that you're registered under, then D.C. knows where to find you and where to inform the public to find you insofar as someone needs to sue you. And while we might think we don't want to be found in that case, it's a requirement. So
one thing I want to mention is that you can't act as your own agent. The entity can't act as its own agent. Like you would have to have an agent that somebody else. You know, you can act as agent for other organizations or other legal entities once you're registered and in compliance, but you can't act serve as your own registered agent like ABC Inc. And then the registered agent is ABC. It has to be.
But an owner could be
the individual person. You can do it. You know, if you have a business office in the district, you can serve as the registered agent for the company, for your own company, but not using your legal name as the registered agent for your own.
Questions? Yes.
Yeah, I have a couple. The first is, I have paid my biannual dues for the PLLC, but I have found somewhere online that my name is mentioned, my company's name is mentioned as owing the dues. I have received that I paid it, so I don't know why, and I don't know how
to do it. Yes, okay, you paid your 2014 report or your 2013 report? And so did it show that you're in a revoked status? Because we already did a revocation for the What did it say?
It was just a list, a PDF list from the DCRA.
Well, that list that we put out was the revocation list. But when you looked at your status, what did it say? Yeah, you have to call.
Let me call.
Mm-hmm. See, I would have to look it up by the name of your organization and see. Now, there are some times when people file their biannual reports and they don't pay the right fee, or sometimes the report form is rejected, depending on how you file. If you file it online, it's going to show up automatically. But if you did it through the paper version, the main thing is to put your corporate file number or your LLC or PLLC file number on that report, because if you don't, then it has to be manually inputted. So, you know, you can call me and I can check it for you, or you can go on. You see, because if you were on that list, that means that's kind of like a red flag if you're on the list. But let's see.
Stay off the list. And on that point, did you want to say something else?
No, I recently, I just Googled myself for some other reason and found this. The other thing I wanted to say is, you don't remember me, but when I did fall to the company, you were very helpful.
Nice.
I just wanted to share this with a class because I came to DCRA you were there sitting in.
Yeah, well, you probably, if I talked to you and I looked up your organization, maybe it's okay. I can't really say that really.
Well, speaking of compliance with the biennial report, something important to bear in mind, it's a little tricky. You form your entity, and then the next April 1 is when you need to do your two-year report. So
come in December 31st, people call and say, look, I just formed my company on December 31st. That was the last business day. Why do I have to file a report, that very next year? But that's what the statute requires. If you can't, you have to file, you had to pay the full fees by that April 1st. It used to be divided up in different months for different type of entities. The LLCs or the PLLCs, they used to be in June when we changed that. When they changed the law, they put everybody at the same time, April 1st. Now, you either be on the even year or the odd year, depending on when you were registered.
What happens if you, I guess we talked a little bit about this, if you don't do the biennial report filing, you end up on this bad list of people to entities to have their charter revoked?
Mm-hmm.
And then how long does that take? And do you get a notice, and can you come back into compliance?
We send out two notices. The first notice is to file the first report. If you have a corporate agent, like one of those commercial registered agents, and the commercial registered agents usually are the ones that represent a whole lot of organizations like CT Corporation, Corporation Service Company. And so they represent a lot, and we send an email to them, and they generate a list and send it to their clients. So we send that first notice to them sometime in either the 1st of March or the end of February, telling them, it's time for you to file. But if they don't do it, then they get a second notice sometime in July or either the end of June, saying this is your last opportunity before revocation. You have to the last business day in August to file the report. If you don't file it by then you're going to be what they call an administrative dissolution, which is really the revocation of the charter.
Can you undo it at that point?
Sure, you can reinstate it, but you have to file at that point. Then you got to file a petition for reinstatement or an application and pay the fee, which is $300 for the reinstatement, and then for the business is $400. And then if you want to do it real fast, you can expedite it as an extra $100.
Mm-hmm.
You can do everything online if you want to.
Actually, go ahead.
I have actually two questions. You may have covered one of them earlier, obviously. The question is, if you have an LLP and you want to dissolve it, is it necessary to always file that this form is listed?
For the DC one.
In general, you want to properly dissolve whatever entity it is. I mean, I don't think there's a requirement that you do it, but there's a requirement that you follow the procedure if you want it to be dissolved.
Okay. I mean, what I was thinking was, what I was going to do was to have a partnership agreement, and then I was going to do another agreement between the partners,
mm-hmm.
saying we're dissolving, and this is how we're going to divide up this and this and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then I didn't realize. I'm glad I saw this. I didn't realize that there was another a form.
I mean,
if you want to be effective with the district,
right,
then you need to file that form, because because otherwise what happened is if you just let it sit there, which a lot of people do,
right,
then we'll just do an administrative dissolution and do, you know, the revoke. But legally, depending on whatever else you have going on, you might want to clear up everything, you know, so it'll be clean slate. Because there's a provision called clean hands. I don't know if you all are familiar with clean hands provision. Well, usually it's a tax form that, you know, it's like a self-certification or a certification, meaning that you don't owe the district government no more than $100, you know, when you do other things. So it's best, you know, if you can, just clean it up. But, you know, a lot of times with economic reasons, some people, you know, have a hard time. But if you ever come back in the district to do business and you want to use that name or whatever, they're going to look at you and say, well, I see, because we still have it on record. It's going to still show that they owe, and then they'll fight in, they'll probably owe more than what the initial fee for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you don't file this, then you could have other costs on top of that.
You could. You could.
Penalties. Or,
yeah. So, and especially if you have, you know, if you want to divide everything legally, sometimes I've had a person, they had real property, they didn't even realize they forgot they had bought something, and they had real property in the business name, and so it was revoked for a whole lot of years, and so when it was time to convey the property, they had to come in and reinstate, because when you go to settlement, you need a certificate of good standing. You can't get a good standing when you're not in compliance. And then the other thing is that, what about your tax? You know, when you want to close it out with the tax office or something like that, they're going to look, a lot of times they'll look at it. So.
Yeah, yeah, it really makes it look difficult to be out of compliance with the regulations.
Thank you for addressing my question.
Sure.
And my other question was regarding sole proprietorships, and you may have addressed this earlier.
No problem.
Right now, I've had an LLP for my firm for the past few years, and we all, partnership files a return in DC, we end up owing like a lot of money on that every year, and then the partners individually, we both reside in Virginia, so then we have our own partnership profits that we're taxed on our, you know, personal income tax returns. And then I was wondering, if I have a sole proprietorship instead of a partnership, then what would the tax implications be of that with regards to the District of Columbia? Because I reside in Virginia, would I still need to file? Would I still have tax liability in D.C. if it's a sole proprietorship, if I have an office in D.C.?
Well, I'm not from the Office of Tax and Revenue.
Right.
I can't.
Yeah, that
you can call there and they'll.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You want to talk to a tax advisor. I think that you, as a sole prop, paying Virginia taxes, doing some work in D.C., if it's you personally doing the services, I don't think you're going to have a D.C.-specific tax reporting obligation. But
I mean, to me, it sounds like it should be a simple question or a simple answer, but of course, as lawyers, we all know that, you know, the clients who come to us and say, I just have a simple question for you.
That's so true.
Oh, sure. Okay. There's no such thing. So I wonder if I think it's simple due to my ignorance of not realizing that it's more complicated because I don't practice in these areas. Mm-hmm.
And I'd be happy to dive in a little bit further
right,
with you afterwards.
Just, if it sounds like, because I know the tax disadvantages that I've had with the partnership for the past few years, and I'm looking for an option that isn't, and I'm thinking, oh, this one sounds like it's more attractive, and you know, surely it must be more attractive.
Cool. Rebecca, did you have a question?
I just wanted to check on, if you are a single member of PLLC, no employees, have I correctly perceived that there is no independent tax filing or franchise filing that needs to be made?
If you're doing 80% or more of the work, if you have an associate doing 25% who's not an owner, then that would not fall within the exception. But my understanding, to be confirmed with tax advisors,
right,
is that you would be exempt from filing. Not only would your tax liability be zero, but you'd be exempt from filing. That's my understanding.
Following up on that same question, if there's a specific document that you need to file to, I guess, confirm that you are doing 80% of
think, is that covered on the F? Maybe you might. I know this is outside of your department, but that might be covered on the FR 500. I'm trying to remember where. Yeah, that's a great question. Where? How does DC know whether or not? And sometimes with tax stuff, you're the one that knows whether or not you're doing what you're supposed to, and you know you want to do what you're supposed to, and you may or may not be found out if you don't. But I think the FR 500 form parses through some of that.
And they have that FR 500 form online at the Office of Tax Revenue, your CFO. They have the form online, and it's a whole lot of questions and things that you could probably, I'm not really sure.
So a question I wanted to ask you, Mrs. Henson, is with respect to doing business in D.C. and being an entity outside of D.C. So say you're a lawyer licensed in Virginia and D.C. or Maryland and D.C. You're coming into D.C. Maybe you have your office here. Maybe you don't. At what point are you doing business and do you need to register as a foreign entity doing business in D.C.?
Well, I always say if you're entering into services or goods to be used within the District of Columbia. So say, for instance, that you don't have an office here, but you're providing your legal service here in the District of Columbia as a legal entity. So we would consider that transacting business.
And then related to that point, go ahead.
Could I ask a nuanced question on that? Mm-hmm. So what does providing service in D.C. mean? If I have a client in...
Giving your legal advice to them in the District of Columbia.
Okay.
Does that have
suppose
more to do with his physical presence in D.C.?
Yeah, that's what
or
I'm getting at. I mean, if I have an office in Virginia...
If they come to Virginia and all your advice and everything is in Virginia, then you wouldn't be actually doing it.
Even if I'm advising them about D.C. law.
Right. I mean, well, you're advising them, but you're in another jurisdiction.
I'm doing my job
in Virginia. But if you're
going
to represent them here in the district, say, for instance, they come to me and they say, well, I'm having this problem here, but I want you to represent me. You give them that advice. And then you follow through and represent them in a case or something like that. And yes, you would have to be.
But just telling them what D.C. law is,
no, you wouldn't have
when to. I'm sitting in my office in Virginia, it doesn't count as doing business, practicing it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, another nuanced question, I guess. If you have a home office, but you are using a D.C. mailing address with, you know, one of the virtual firms.
Right, a virtual office.
Right, so you're giving advice from your home office. May or may not, which is not in this scenario.
Right, but when you use that business, just remember, when you use that D.C. business address, you are holding yourself out or representing that you have an office here in the District of Columbia.
Right, okay.
So it's going to be conceived that you are transacting business, even though it might be one of those virtual offices, which a lot of time people have these offices on Cape Street or somewhere, and it's like a big open space, but they have like little desks set aside. Mm-hmm. You know, ones that, you know, they may not be attorneys, they could be any type of business. But they're using on their letterhead, and when they contact the public, they're going to have that D.C. business address. So, yes, that would be considered transacting business.
So something I want to circle back to, you had asked earlier, sorry, I think, about the jurisdictional questions and you know, where to form and how and why. So it's interesting for lawyers in law firms, lawyers in general. We hear a lot about selecting a jurisdiction that makes sense from a business standpoint in general, setting aside the being lawyers for a second. And I think that that is less relevant to us. I don't think, for example, even though, you know, if you're going to enter into an agreement with partners or you're going to have a corporation, Delaware is the longstanding preferred jurisdiction to do that. I don't think you can form in Delaware because that'd be subject to their rules of professional conduct. A law firm in Delaware when you're not licensed in Delaware. So we have this kind of added overlay applicable. But I think where the question becomes more relevant is where you have more than one jurisdiction, you know, in the vicinity, where you are licensed in D.C. and you are licensed in Virginia and perhaps Delaware. And in that case, you know, looking at how much it's going to cost to do business might be a particularly relevant concern. And I think where it comes into play even more is in this local region, someone had already mentioned, you know, it's not uncommon to be licensed in two or three of the jurisdictions in the DMV. And in that case, I think where you want to have your office, how that interplays with where you're licensed, where you're registered. I mean, if you're sometimes it works out well to be registered in one jurisdiction, then doing business in another Although you do need to be registered in both of those entities, at least as a foreign entity, and the one where you're not domestically registered. And I've seen some interesting combinations where, you know, because it's a DC PC with S Corp election, I might get this not quite right, the residents, the attorney who's the main one who's actually in Maryland, that somehow is tax favorable. I actually don't know why, I don't know the details, but the specifics matter, and I think it really drives towards, I mean, a tax treatment consideration, which is that tax treatment and liability are really the two big drivers that you just hear over and over again. A nuance with regard to naming when you're a foreign entity, I myself am formed in Maryland. I'm a resident of Maryland, and I'm licensed in both Maryland and D.C. And then I started taking on D.C. clients even before I moved my office to D.C., and I promptly, because I'm a corporate lawyer and I, you know, have to practice what I preach, I promptly filed my foreign registration. But, of course, an interesting aspect is that Maryland doesn't require an LLC. They don't even have the form PLLC, but D.C. does. So I formed my entity domestically in Maryland as Batzel Law LLC, but in D.C., I need to hold myself out as Batzel Law PLLC. So it's you have to make sure that your name, for purposes of D.C., conforms with the D.C. naming requirements for the type of entity that you are.
And what happens is they don't make you change your name in your jurisdiction. There's a section on the FN1 that's going to say alternative name. So you just, in her particular case, her name is still the name that she has in Maryland with LLC. But in the district, she just adopted PLLC. But her true, you know, corporate, her true name would be under whatever she's organized in the state of Maryland. But we just have a space there where they could just change that indicator.
So the PLLC... for DC purposes, in your case, Heather, is a trade name?
No, it's not a trade name. This is the name that she's using in the District of Columbia.
You register, it's interesting, it's like kind of almost like
right. In Maryland,
six
like,
and one half dozen and another. But
it's a foreign registration name.
Right. Well, yeah. It's just, there is adopting that particular, like in Maryland, a lot of times, instead of PC, they might use PA for professional associate. Mm-hmm. But when they come to DC, they'll say DC, unless they use chartered or something like that.
And just as a practical measure, and I'll get to your question in a second, as a practical measure, when I was just doing business in D.C., but my principal office was still in Maryland, I didn't like update my logo, but when I decided I wanted to actually move back to D.C. because I missed it after 9 months away, I updated it, and so now I really do hold myself out primarily as Batzel Law PLLC because my office is here, and to not leave any concern or...
But there's not a legal entity called...
You're right. I mean, I agree that it sounds kind of similar to a trade name. It's just that's not what it is for formal
purposes.
It's not
a legal. It's not a new legal entity. It's still
it's Batzel Law LLC doing business as. This is what I really see. So, go ahead with your question.
My question is related to what
you're
talking about now. The two
different
names, the PLLC and LLC. Because I'm curious about the PLLC. Because when you're doing business in, say, Maryland, do you have the basic I mean, I know registration purposes, they're separate in a jurisdiction, but when you're actually doing the business and, communicating with clients, you have to change the name?
I don't know the answer to your question. I suspect the answer is, whenever you're holding yourself out in the district, including technically correspondence, it should reflect the name that adheres to district DC law. Practically speaking, I don't know that the letterhead will be, the thing that gets you in trouble or out of compliance. Do you have a different view?
No. In fact, we don't have any jurisdiction in Maryland, so I don't think that, it would get you in any trouble. Mm-hmm. You just adopted because of the requirements. That's basically. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you guys have been such troopers, and everybody's awake. I'm thrilled because when I was running through this yesterday, I'm like, oh no, it's boring. And I'm really glad that you've been so participatory and asked a lot of questions because that's where it's interesting. The general here's a list of the traits is not the most interesting part. It's the application of it that I think is really interesting and why I like this part of my job. so Yeah, moving on. Just kind of summary and chief considerations. Like as we discussed, liability and taxation are really the front runner issues. So here are kind of my thoughts as to how you pull all this together. My default, when I'm counseling clients, when I'm thinking about my own business, is to form a limited liability entity. That doesn't mean it's always the right answer. It's just a default position for me. And then the question is, which one? You have the corporation, which I think, if you're contemplating a corporation, I think you need to consider carefully if it's worthwhile for you. A lot of the reasons that typically and historically have driven people towards corporations are not so applicable here because of the lawyer aspect, as well as the diminution of the S-corp benefit. Then you have your LLCs and your LLPs. If you're going to form by yourself, you can't be an LLP. You need more than one member to form an LLP. So LLC is your option as between these two. Excuse me. And if you're a group of lawyers, if you're two or more lawyers entering into business together, it depends. So both of the forms have the limited liability and the pass-through tax treatment, and either the partnership tax treatment in full with all its complexities and nuances, or in the case of an LLC, the ability to have that and also some optionality as to other ways to structure it from a tax, capital, and management perspective. So as between the LLP and the LLC is more flexible, and it can be more like a partnership or it can be less like a partnership in its attributes. And for me, that flexibility highly recommends the LLC. You know, you hear different people with different views. Some people call the LLC the holy grail, you know, since the 90s or whenever it was that the IRS, the LLCs have been around longer, I think 30 or 40 years, but in the 90s or thereabouts, the IRS decided that it could actually not have to choose like two out of four of the really favorable attributes and could just have limited liability and flow through taxation and perpetual duration and all these things. So some people call it the holy grail, but I think, you know, it's a nuanced decision, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. And so while an LLC might frequently be an excellent choice, you need to evaluate it together with your specific factors. I think, you know, a second area for consideration is really thinking about your potential liabilities in general, notwithstanding what I said about my default being that a limited liability entity is a good way to go. You can think about what your potential liabilities are and whether or not the less protective sole prop or GP is better or worse for you as compared to the professional corporation, the LLP, or the PLLC, and consider whether or not the expenses and efforts outweigh the benefits, because the GP and the sole prop are very flexible. You just start doing it and do what you want. You might have consequences later if you don't reduce any of it to writing, but you don't have to reduce it to writing, and you can run with it. But the potential liabilities, notwithstanding the lack of ability to disclaim your professional liability, could be in contracts in general, vendors, financiers, employee issues, leases, I don't know if I mentioned torts, and then your other partners' malpractice. And that list is not too short for my comfort, you know, to pay the couple hundred bucks to register and to maintain the ongoing filings. But that's a personal decision as far as risk allocation.
How many of those vendors are going to allow you to not assume personal liability?
Yeah, that's a great
you know, I have a
great
lease
point.
And it says that I'm personally liable, so I don't think, you know, in that sense. I'm actually a big fan of sole proprietorships. They're free. Banks don't have a problem with them. Last forever, there's no fees to pay ever on them, you know. And you can get a tax ID, which you can stop using your personal social security number. The IRS loves that. And if you have an LLC, a single member LLC, then you can also, which will be disregarded, and you can file it like a sole proprietorship, and everything just falls into your personal tax ID.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So you like the LLC, or you like the sole prop, or you like the single member LLC?
Well, sole prop is by far the
right.
And most vendors aren't going to let you use the business name and then go under. You know, they're going to hold the person.
and it depends. It depends. I mean, that's frequently true at the outset.
The business has credit and can get services at the end of the business, then that might be good. But if you don't have any credit, then I don't see what you're
doing. Well, I mean, some vendors, like my Lexus contract, did not ask for a personal guarantee. So, you know, I agree. It's a weighing of costs and benefits, and what does it really mean in your specific circumstances? You know, having employees, I mean, you know, harassment, wrongful discharge, these, you know, all employees are liabilities. I mean, they're great, and hopefully they do really good work for you, too, but they do give rise to a lot of liabilities. And this point about, you know, personally guaranteeing, you're absolutely right, of course, that undermines your limited liability. You have limited liability to the extent you don't agree otherwise, but, you know, after you're in business for a few years, you may well not have to continue personally guaranteeing, and so that can be a factor in determining. And if you start in 3 years, your limited liability entity, because you're waiting for that to happen, you might still have to run the three or 5 years out until you can get credit in the name of your entity. So, I think you're quite right that there's a lot of considerations.
Well, I'll go one step further and say that this competent tax advisor might need. LLC taxation is not a trivial topic. The American Bar Association has a wonderful paper published in 2007 called Common Drafting Mistakes.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it.
Which I highly recommend. It reads you the Riot Act of every student in the such as treating like a corporation, for example. The shares should not be treated as fungible because they might have other attributes. And then there's a book called The Logic of Subchapter K, which is recommended by some other law firms, the Bible for Partnership Taxation. Partnership taxation is an extremely complicated area. And you better follow it or the IRS will bust you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to know. And you better, and in particular, do not ever deviate from your percentage interest, because if you do something that's not in accord with percentage interest, you better have a very good reason for it that's justified by the regs, or allocating something different than according to. Now, you can give somebody 1% and keep 99%. That's not difficult. But don't try to change it, and, you know, don't shift anything around, because, there's minefields everywhere.
But you said common drafting errors in LLC agreements.
And I can send it to you, Bill. Ben, I have it.
Common drafting errors. You will, drafting and reviewing LLC agreements, you'll get this article which tells you.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, that really kind of dovetails nicely with my final point, which is that, you know, my suggestion is that hopefully the survey has and lively discussion, which I thought was fantastic, gives you some inkling as to maybe the two that you're considering that might make sense for you. And then you want to dive into those deeper, and in particular with competent tax advisor, because absolutely, if you're talking about going into business with someone else and you're contemplating a partnership or an LLC acting like a partnership, you need to know what you're getting yourself into.
This person has one and only one capital. You better know this, or else you're going to make all kinds of horrendous
errors. I think that sounds about right. So
like, this is intended to conform with subchapter K, and then include language that blatantly.
Here are just a few resources that I like. The DCRA website is really great. I mean, I don't think it was 10 years ago or 8 years ago. I don't remember when it's been overhauled, but it's really looking pretty good, and it's pretty easily navigable, and I recommend it. This is their particular link to just starting your business, and kind of gives you a nice overview of what all you need to do. You need to do your corporate registration. Here's some stuff on the different corporate forms. Here's the costs, here's what you file, then go look at your tax stuff, and then go look at your permit and licensing stuff. So that's helpful, as well as the second one, doing business in D.C. also. Oh, that's a D.C. Gov page, actually. And then we have the Office of Tax and Revenue, where you look to find out more about these tax registration requirements, such as the form FR-500. And I'm on the IRS website, I mean, not every day, because, you know, I'm not a tax lawyer, but I would say every month. It has a wealth of information. And then finally, this WDCEP, it's something in economic partnership. It's Washington, D.C. Community Economic Partnership. has some great resources. In fact, they have some of this book, which I've had for a couple years. I don't remember where I got it, but this is a DCRA or DC, WDCEP publication with lots of DCRA information. And Mrs. Henson can tell us what's available.
We have the Business Resource Center, in which we have a whole lot of publications. And what they do, if you go to the DCRA's website, they have a calendar and events if you're ever interested in coming to any of the workshops that they have. And they have people from the Office of Tax and Revenue that comes there periodically. Sometimes we have someone from the IRS, the Small Business Administration, and we're there all the time. And then there's other resources that come there, people that on grant writing and stuff like that, if you're ever interested in a nonprofit or anything. You can go to DCRA's website, and then you can see in the header or the toolbars, you'll see what is called the Business Resource Center.
And then it sometimes has on the side there, like kind of upcoming events.
Upcoming
and such.
Events and things like that. Yeah.
Sure. Another question?
Well, it just seems to me that the question of choosing the entity is one thing, but then it sounds like there's plenty of minefields once you've chosen it, just to make sure you do it right. And if you're not a practicing expert in the field like you are, you know, sort of like going to a doctor who doesn't specialize in your problem, you're kind of taking your life.
Yeah, well, a couple of points. The first thing is, I think a lot is to be said for setting up properly. I mean, if you do the heavy lifting and you really figure out in your operating agreement, for example, in an LLC, how you're going to operate the entity, and then hopefully that trusted tax advisor who worked with you or your legal advisor to come up with the agreement, you know, ideally is good and stays in the mix with you and helps you look after your quarterly and or annual filing obligations. I mean, a lot of it is, when you're talking about the partnership and the LLC acting as a partnership, a lot of it's partnership and accounting stuff. But if you have a good agreement that sets out how you're going to operate the business and you follow it, then that's a good guide. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's highly recommendable. And then as to your point about, you know, competency and knowing what you're doing. Yeah, some people, I mean, I've had some law firm clients, and usually when a member of the DC bar calls me, I say, oh, well, we're, you know, colleagues at the bar. Do you want me to walk you through that? You can do it yourself. And most of the time I say, no, I don't know what I'm doing. So lawyers are much more, in my experience, likely to say, that's not my area. Would you just do it for me? Than, you know, startups I work with are like, yeah, I can do whatever. I mean, this, you think this is hard? I'm like developing, you know, the next greatest thing in the world to solve major world problems. I think that you have a healthy appreciation because you're a lawyer, and probably there's a lot that you could learn by recognizing what the issues are and what you don't know. And then insofar as you determine it's more than you know, then you do reach out to a competent corporate legal counsel.
When a lawyer says, I'm not my expertise, you know, do it for me, do you usually... how do you coordinate with the tax counsel? Do you say, tell me who your tax counsel is and I want to work with that person? Or
either or both. I mean, I let it be driven by the client. And some clients are like, oh, yeah, well, you guys just talk. And other types say, hey, I'm happy to talk directly and say, oh, no, just tell me what I need to check. And I say, okay, well, here's what you need to check. I mean, I hope they do a good job. I can't give you any perspective on whether or not they do.
Right.
But it varies.
All right, thanks.
So,
PLLC, you get a tax identification number from the IRS, but all the income, the proprietor, all the income flows through anyways under your own Social Security number and tax return. What's the purpose of the business TIN? Does it have a particular reason?
Okay, a couple of purposes for the tax ID number. One is the TIN is also called the FEIN, Federal Employer. Identification number. If you have employees, I think you need one, even if you're a sole prop. Can you do that sort of thing?
If you have employees.
Mm-hmm. And then as a practical matter, if you have a single member LLC, and you go to open your bank account, you need to have a separate bank account. They ask you. I mean, my experience and the experience of several people I've talked to, they say, okay, I want a copy of your charter, and I want a copy of your tax ID number. So, and it's really easy. I did mine on my iPhone. It took like 60 seconds. I uploaded the PDF to Dropbox, and I was done. I mean, it's that easy. So, and it fields you through the questions. So if you're not eligible for some reason, it will presumably tell you that, and you can call and talk to them further. So, okay, I think I'll just leave you with, you know, which entity to form or not form. It should be a thoughtful endeavor. I think you can glean that from my comments up till now. And it should be really tailored to your needs. I hope the presentation has been helpful in identifying what some of the areas that you need to explore further. And I thank you for letting us share our insights with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather and Maxine.